Accession number 29894, Reel 6.
Reel 6, Mrs. Elizabeth Small.
Yes.
Yes, it must have been so eerie.
It was.
Having that these
it
were the
was.
First rockets, after all,
yes,
weren't they?
Yes, they're the first rockets. And we had one that came, I thought, near us. I was asleep, and I was thrown out of my bed, and I remember thinking, well, there's no glass come in. The block of flats where Mrs. MacArthur lived was this Victorian building, as I say. We were on the fifth floor, and it had two wings going side, and our bedrooms faced in, and so there was a gap between the two wings. I think on two occasions it saved us, because it took the blast. Well, the front of the hang was where you could see it over London, and was very vulnerable, but the side where our bedrooms were was protected. So the fact that my window hadn't come in, I got back into bed and went to sleep. The next morning, Mrs. MacArthur said, "And where were you last night?" I said, "Well, it was a big bang, and I went back to bed." And she said, "Well, for your information, the front door has been blown in and the front window." So I said, "Well, there wasn't much I could do about that. We're lucky." However, when I went out to go to work, I thought, well, where's it fallen? Is it done all this damage? Where is it? There wasn't a sign. The houses in front were all intact. And I walked down the road, down to get the number 2 bus, and I didn't see anything. And I thought, well, you know. And then suddenly... And I said,
"You were looking for this V2.
Did you have to look here?" Yes. Ooh. And then suddenly I saw where a house had been. I couldn't remember, because there were nice houses on that road. They had at one time been very, very, very quite luxury houses, old. No, there was nothing there whatsoever. It was so clean. It was completely clean, not like the fly bombs when everything was all over everywhere and scattered and everything. There was not a sign of anything. It was just an enormous hole, as clean as a whistle. And that shook me. I got to the office and I was all of a tremble. And I thought that this is the devil, this is. It really is a devilish thing. And so it was. But
you say 60 on London.
Yes.
Would have been,
I think it would have made it. Well, of course, Hitler thought he was going to. He had in mind, you know, to really finish the war off. I can't say. Who can say what would have happened? It didn't happen, and there we were. But they were unstoppable. That was the thing, and you never heard them until they'd come, because they were faster than sound, and to me they were terrifying. And luckily, I mean, we had quite a lot, and other places had them too, but not in great numbers that would have really incapacitated a place completely with the blast and so on. But they were what is the first rocket. And the man who, again, this is, I didn't know it at the time, I hesitate, but the German who was, this German scientist who was at the back of those, he was taken prisoner by the Americans, and he helped with the American project to go to the moon, and also do whatever they wanted him to do as a way of defence. But this is afterwards. This is what you learn a long time afterwards.
Yes, you were saying about the, you know, the risk to the agents after D-Day,
yes.
you know, emerging.
Yes.
I expect you had, it must have been very upsetting when you knew people, or as
yes.
you were saying earlier, you got
yes.
the feel of a person by, you know, their signals.
Yes.
And,
oh, yes.
Did you...
And of course, if you had their file, you knew about their life. The family, and if they had any, or where, or what, and so they weren't just an unknown name. That you've got to know them in a way, in a vague way. I mean, some people, the Miss Atkins, she used to see off the agents and so on, and she was put in uniform, may I say, because she was a civilian, but. I'm glad, really, I didn't have to do that, because it's all right when they come back and they're all right, but not when they don't. And in fact, at the end, as far as I was concerned, when everything was finished in France, there was no more work to be done from the point of view of operations or anything else, not in France. I thought the ending was very sad, and I saw it sadder still when I began to hear what had happened to the people who were missing, because after all we knew was that they were missing, and the end of many of them was quite horrific. There again, this is well, no, it wasn't afterwards. Vera Atkins. Oh, what shall I? Shall I just let it ring?
Mm-hmm. The horrific end of the
horrific
agents.
Terrible. Vera Atkins, who was the sort of second to Colonel Buckmaster, and did a lot of going to the airfields, seeing them off, and especially the women agents. At the end, when I said, right, you know, I was going to leave, she said, what are you going to do now? I didn't know her. In fact, most of us didn't know anything about her. She was an enigmatic character and kept herself very much to herself, and but very competent, older than I was. And she said, oh, and so I said, why do you ask? And she said, oh, well, I have a job to do, and I wondered if you'd be interested in coming with me. She, as always, didn't say what it was or anything, and I, by that time, had enough, and it was time I went back home and tried to cope with a sick father and mother and one thing and another, and it was time I went home. And so I said that. I said, oh, no, I finished what I wanted to do, and also I quite frankly didn't think we'd get on very well. I hadn't anything personal in any way against her, but I couldn't see us working in harmony. Just one of those things. And of course, it was a long time afterwards before I realized that she went over to find out what had happened, especially to the missing women agents. And that was her job, and it was a dreadful job, and she had to attend war trials, crime trials, try and see what. And her, what I have read since that she found, well, it would have finished me. I was too sensitive to cope, but she was a tough lady. She had to be, and also someone had to do that job, and I give her full marks for undertaking it, but I'm thank goodness I wasn't with her. I wouldn't have enjoyed it at all. Awful.
Did you ever have any connections with the safe house in Bury, Sussex? I forget the name of the lady, but I know there was a safe house in West Burton or Bury in Sussex where the pilots and people who were going to be dropped stayed overnight for Tangmere. Does that ring a bell with you?
There was a what they called a cottage at Tangmere, and nobody was none of the normal RAF personnel were allowed in it at all. So there must have been somebody who was running that, because that's where they were received before it was found out who they were and where they were to go and etc. etc. But I didn't meet her or anything like that. But sometime afterwards, a friend of mine who was in the RAF and was at Tangmere, and she said, "Oh, we were always so curious to know about the cottage." And we were never allowed anywhere near, but that's where they were received when the Lysanders came back. But more than that, I don't know. One learned so much afterwards. There's no doubt about it. And having been told, and I agree, the less you know, the better. I think that is something which anybody who is working in any undercover organisation should always remember, because you can give something away without knowing you have done.
Yes, I was wondering, you know, you were saying the difficulty of not having uniform.
Yes.
And, for instance, when you saw your parents,
yeah, exactly.
And they were saying, "What are you doing?"
Yes.
What could you tell them?
Exactly.
Yes,
exactly.
It was very difficult.
It was terribly difficult. And I remember my mother saying once, "Oh, you used to be so open, so easy and open, and now you're so closed about certain things." And I think in a way, I've never stopped in a certain way. My first husband was an agent, and he was a Belgian. I didn't marry him until a long time afterwards, but we never talked much about it, and in Belgium certainly not. Very careful indeed, because there were so many, and this has nothing to do with the war, but there were so many who were Flemish and were pro-German. Naturally, one feels, because they were Germanic stock. And you didn't know who was who, and you didn't talk about the war. I mean, in his own family, he had a sister-in-law had her head shaved off because she was supposed to have had a German boyfriend, and so it went on. And I think that it's the same in any country that's been occupied. Spain is another one that's never recovered from a civil war, and I have my daughter-in-law is Spanish. And her story is quite interesting, her family and so on. But she won't. And I said, "Oh, it would make a marvellous something on the television, as a love story, in fact, because it ends nicely." But she, no, you can't. Oh, certainly not. No, you mustn't at all. And I found it, you know. But I begin to understand it, because I hear that Spain now, and they've never talked about the Civil War, but now grandchildren are. Is it running still? Well, this has nothing to do with my war experience, but...
Oh, it is, because I think these things are related.
You see,
business of keeping stuff in. And
people are saying, "Well, what happened to Uncle so-and-so?" "Oh, well, he disappeared." And then now I'm told that there is a law in Spain that they can, in fact, exhume some cemeteries. And now there's DNA, so they can find out who they are. And this is not very good for peace of mind for some of them.
So, when did you meet your husband? Was this when you were working there?
Yes, I met him at the end of the war when he'd come back, and he was sent by the Belgian section, not the French section. But that is when I first met him. But our paths crossed. It was the end of the war. He had to go back, but that is when I first met him, and we had the same. Trouble in Belgium, but there is trouble even to this day between French and Flemish, and it all goes back to the split in the war. And you don't talk about these things. You keep quiet.
Mm-hmm. You were talking about this double agent that
yes.
you were suspicious of.
Yes.
Were there any others that you met during the war who turned out to be double
yes,
agents?
Yes, it was someone in the section.
Who was that?
Well, perhaps I shouldn't name names. I mean, he defended Dericourt at his trial. And he was a colonel, and apart from Miss Atkins, who wouldn't speak to him after some time, he was second to Buckmaster. And now, of course, we hear all kinds of things about how he knew Dericourt before the war, etc., etc. Well, that again, it's what has happened since. He had been an agent. Agents were not supposed to go back into occupied France, but some of them did, and he did. And there again, mysterious things happened with the people that he was supposed to be meeting. It didn't add up. But he's long since dead, but I think keep his name out of it. But this is what is horrid about intelligence work. I mean, ours in a sense was not like normal MI5, MI6. Our paths crossed to the horror of MI6, but they couldn't help it, really. But ours was something set up for the war to try and help the resistance of whatever country you could help. I mean, not just France. They were all over the place, SOE. They were in Burma and helping the Chindits and Italy and all over the place. But the object was not the usual espionage that you can think of. It was to aid and abet anybody who was going to resist the Germans. That was the idea of the organisation. It got out of hand in some respects because paths crossed inevitably with other people who were there sent by MI6, for instance. And so there was a certain, in fact, there was obviously a lot of animosity, but that one discovers long after, and in my case, of course, knew nothing about it at all, thank goodness. Better not to know these things.
It's interesting you saying earlier on, too, about the animosity from the Gaullists.
Well,
towards
you.
Yeah.
De Gaulle was a difficult creature to he was a one-off. He was the right person in the right time, really, for France. But I mean, as far as Churchill was concerned, as we hear on many occasions, he was a law unto himself, de Gaulle, and was going to do what he thought. Well, he was not in a position to do as he thought. He hadn't got him without us and then the Americans. He wasn't getting anywhere. So that was, there are times when you've got to be more diplomatic, and that's one thing he was not at all, not at all.
Did you have any VIP visits to Baker Street, 64 Baker Street, while you were there? Did any of the Churchill ever come, or anyone?
Well, not that I was aware of. I mean, our head at the time was General Gubbins, and he was not referred to as Gubbins. You know, he was not C, but what did they say if they were rang him up? Anyway, he was over at 64 Baker Street. The sort of hierarchy was over there, and there was a very clever man who did codes. And he has died just recently, a civilian, a Jewish civilian called Marx, a man called Mr. Marx, whose father kept a bookshop and became famous afterwards because he was in correspondence with America, an American woman, and kept sending her books throughout the war. And you've probably, yes, I think a film has been made of it. Certainly there's a book about it. Well, Mr. Marx, the one we knew, was the son of Marx, who had the bookshop. And he was a very, very clever, the sort of thing that landed up at Bletchley. And I think he was almost started at Bletchley and was, so I understand, didn't get on or something. And he landed up with us as our cipher, and he was the one that made up the codes and things. He, brilliant, but very strange. And when he was civilian, and if he was speaking, you picked up the phone and someone said, "Marx here." Marx here. And he was brilliant. A brilliant brain that you had to have, I think, those people have actually a brilliant brain. But I think that was possibly the best kept secret of the lot.
Yes, I'm going to ask you about that, but this is the end of Reel 6.
Yes, yes. And just...